The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Senate Judiciary Committee recently held a hearing on police brutality entitled Police Use of Force and Community Relations. We're going to hear from some of the witnesses, but first, here's U.S. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey.
Mr. Chairman, I think, departing from my prepared remarks, just want to say, what does it say about a nation where two senators from the same state have very different, wildly different experiences with law enforcement right here? In these last few weeks, I've had conversations with Black folks who work for the Senate, people on both sides of the aisle, who all have their shares of stories of traumatizing experiences, of feeling like they were one sudden move or one mistaken moment for experiencing violence. And the challenge is that this has been nothing new. I think if we took the time to listen to each other, we would see that we have a culture where so many parents have to teach their children to be afraid in order to be secure. I heard moving comments on the floor today about one of my colleagues who listened to their staffers where their kids were told by their parents to keep your receipts because you'll be accused of stolen things. I know from my own experiences, having guns drawn on me, being accused of stealing things. The challenge is that this often is unfair, it is unacceptable, it is wrong, but when it explodes like we see it, where people capture on videotape the kind of violence that you were, traumatizing violence that you were going to show. I'm really grateful for Senator Harris, who's been my partner over the last few weeks. And she and I did, as was said by the ranking member, work together with congressional Black caucus leaders and ultimately Chairman Nadler to put together a bill called the Justice in Policing Act. We put it together, obviously, in the wake of George Floyd. We put it in the wake of not just Black men, a Black woman sleeping in her home, and the deaths that have brought to attention much of this in our national discourse, and indeed have brought in all 50 states literally thousands of protests of people of all backgrounds. I mean all backgrounds, not just race, religion. Who've been calling for an end, a meaningful reform. And yet, even in the days since Kamala and I put together our work with other members of this Senate, as well as people in the House, we continue to see things caught in videotape, as was said before, Rashard Brooks shot in the back. So we need to be very clear. What we're talking about is a nation that has two different justice systems, two different experiences with law enforcement that go all the way up to this body, if you stop and talk to the Black people who work here, who have very personal stories, including Senator Tim Scott's eloquent exposition on the Senate floor. The unmitigated killing of unarmed Black people in America by law enforcement, not to mention the disparate treatment, is something that we must do something about. We have a choice right now. Now, I'm about 51 years old, and since a little bit before my birth till now, there have been so many studies, so many commissions, from the Kerner Commission all the way up to the 21st Century Task Force on Policing. And nothing has changed. Cities from Ferguson to Minneapolis have done a lot of reforms. And as the data has shown, whether it's diversifying your police force, a lot of these things have been done before, but we still see the killing of unarmed African Americans. And so we really have a choice to make. And every day that we don't do something puts more and more of our fellow citizens in danger, not just of death, but of the kind of treatment we would never want our own family to face. We have a choice between us, before us. And so this idea that there is a Republican bill and a Democratic bill, we need to look beyond that for a second and simply understand that the things that are in the bill that Senator Harris and I worked on actually have wild popularity amongst Republicans. You hear Republican leaders from George Bush, his first address to Congress, said we should stop racially profiling Americans. That's not something radical. It's this idea that we're equal under the law. From chokeholds to no-knock warrants, things that would have saved lives, we have failed to do in this country by making them the law of the land, setting standards for practices and policing that reflect our common values. Republicans and Democrats overwhelmingly support these kind of practices being banned in our country that are in our bill. They would save lives. Breonna Taylor would be alive today. Eric Garner could be alive today. But it's not just setting a standard. Accountability is having ways of measuring progress to those standards. We are a nation that doesn't even collect the data on how many people are shot by police. I ran a police department. I learned the hard way. Without data, there can be no accountability. Without measures, I played football. It's not the standard is you got to be fast to be a wide receiver. If you have no way of measuring that, what good is the standard? Activists, local leaders, the federal government, we all should have transparency into policing. Without that, no accountability. And finally, you said it yourself. Took note of what you said, Mr. Chairman, that unless there are real consequences when you fail to meet standards, where there's lawsuits or federal action, criminal court, there are two aspects of this bill, changing a standard in the criminal courts, it's almost difficult, if not impossible, to meet the willfulness standard. That's common sense. And God, qualified immunity, I could start listing, and for sake of time, I won't, all the conservative organizations from the Cato Institute, from the remarks of Clarence Thomas, that support getting rid of qualified immunity. And so I worry in this moment, I really do, that we're going to repeat history, that this is the movie Groundhog Day. Because here we are again, in a nightmare, not a comedy. That here we hear talks of, again, a so-called reform package. It's more studies, more nibbling around the edges, as opposed to acting boldly and doing the things that we actually know will hold police officers accountable for their conduct, which will set meaningful standards, will allow us as a federal government to enforce a law. This is not an overstatement or an overdramatization to say that the stakes right now are high. Will we meet this moment in history and actually do something real, or will we find ourselves back here again a year from now, 3 years from now, with mass protests in the streets by people of all different backgrounds demanding change? And so, Mr. Chairman, the truth is, I actually have faith in us as a country. I don't have faith we're going to get there on time, and justice delayed is justice denied. I, though, believe that there's going to be a time in America when we ban inhuman practices like chokeholds and religious profiling and no-knock entries. I believe there'll be a time in America where we don't treat mental health issues with police and prison. I believe there's going to be a time in America where a black woman is safe to sleep in her own bed, or a young man reaching for his cell phone won't get shot dead. I believe there will be a time in America when black parents, like mine, don't have to fear for the safety of their child who just got their driver's license. I believe there will be a time in America when we understand that public safety is not about simply the number of police on our streets, but about the number of people who no longer live in poverty or are safe to drink their water or don't have to deal with addiction in prison but can get treatment. There will be a time, I know, in this country, but if the arc of the moral universe is long and bends towards justice, we have to have the courage now to be the arc benders. The question is not, will we get there? The question is the time now. How many more people have to die in our streets to get us there? How many more people have to suffer the indignities that even our own colleagues have talked about in the United States Senate? I believe the time should be now for us to make bold change, or we will be back here again. These changes will happen, but they should not happen someday. This should be the day. This should be the time so that we can ensure that this nightmare ends in America.
That was Senator Cory Booker speaking in the Senate Judiciary Committee in the opening of a hearing entitled Police Use of Force and Community Relations. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, let's hear from S. Lee Merritt with Merritt Law Firm of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mr. Merritt is a civil rights attorney and activist.
Senator Graham, other members of this honorable committee, we live in the deadliest police culture and most incarceration-prone police culture in the modern world. Our criminal justice and legal system is as ravenous as it is racist. Our law enforcement community racks up thousands of civilian deaths each year. Tens of thousands more are brutalized, injured, and maimed. Millions more are arrested and jailed, making the United States the single most incarcerated nation in the entire history of the world. This is an American crisis, a genocide. This is not hyperbole, but rather a reality that demands a national response, and I want to thank this committee for taking immediate, swift, and responsive action. I come before you today as a civil rights attorney, a practitioner. I am the legal director for the Grassroots Law Project, and I represent families of citizens killed by police. Some of the names you know, far too many you have not heard. I represent the family of Ahmaud Arbery, who was murdered by a former police officer, Gregory McMichael, his son, Travis McMichael, and their neighbor, William Bryan. While I'm here to provide testimony about justice and policing, and Ahmaud Arbery was not killed in an officer-involved shooting, it was failures in policing that directly contributed to his death and the delay of justice to his family. Neighbors initially sought help for the black jogger that frequented their neighborhood that they considered suspicious from Officer Ronald Rash of the Glenn County Police Department. He encouraged them to pursue a course of vigilantism. He was aware for months that these men were actively hunting a black suspect to whom they intended to do harm. Once the deed was done, it was law enforcement that lied to Wanda Cooper Jones, Ahmaud's mother, telling her that her son had been killed in the course of a robbery by the homeowner. Local DAs Jackie Johnson and George Barnhill participated in the cover-up of his shooting. The Glenn County Police Chief, where this crime occurred, was subsequently arrested on completely separate criminal corruption allegations, along with a handful of his top officials. Ahmaud's story is not just tragic and unjust. It lays bare the need for a reimagining of police in America and their mission in our society. I run a practice dedicated exclusively to responding to police murders. I'm one of many attorneys that has this crisis at the root of their firm as this nation churns out enough bodies and human rights violations to keep us all occupied for a very long time. I continue to stand for the family of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin and other officers of the Minneapolis Police Department held him down for 8 minutes and 46 seconds under the unbearable weight of oppression. He could not breathe, and as the nation looked on in horror, we could not breathe. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellis and Minnesota's top law enforcement official preemptively declared that this would be a case difficult to prosecute. As hard as that is to accept, given the evidence we have now seen with our own eyes, it is consistent with the American experience. Because of existing laws that basically give carte blanche to law enforcement to kill at will with the utterance of these five words, I feared for my life. Hard-fought, rare prosecutions and difficult convictions have characterized the experiences of families like Botham Jean. He was killed in his apartment complex eating a bowl of ice cream. His killer, Amber Geiger, said that she was instructed, that she was trained, that if you can't see the suspect's hands, shoot him. Tatiana Jefferson, also gunned down in her own home, after leaving the door open to catch a cool breeze of relief from the heat of the night in Fort Worth, Texas. Fort Worth Police Officer Aaron Dean crept around the back curtilage of her home, saw her standing in the window and shot her through the bedroom as she played video games with her nephew. The beautiful families that I've traveled with represent a cross-section of America. Disproportionately black, undeniably strong, relentlessly committed to the cause of justice and policing. They include the father of a young woman named Maggie Brooks. Her father is a fire chief in Arlington, Texas. His daughter was accidentally shot by a police officer who recklessly shot at her 6-month-old puppy, but struck Ms. Brooks instead, killing her. Qualified immunity has banned her family access to the court. Under the current federal laws, there will be no criminal or civil liability for this officer or his department. They include the family of Michael Dean, who went out to get his 6-year-old daughter a birthday cake and never made it home. I wish I could tell you what happened to Michael Dean, but the video has still not been released by the department, although the officer has been indicted on manslaughter charges. This family has still not been allowed to see the body or dash cam evidence of what happened to their loved one, They have been denied access to these videos by the city of Temple, Texas, and Bell County District Attorney Henry Garza. Cameron Lamb of Kansas City, Missouri, was unarmed and shot in his place of business and his home. The chief of police in Kansas City, Missouri, has broken with the local district attorney and refused to submit a probable cause affidavit in the case, making prosecution very difficult. Jamel Roberson was a hero from Chicago. He was working as a security guard at a nightclub when the nation was hobbling from one mass shooting to another. A gunman entered his club and began shooting indiscriminately at patrons. Jamel sprang into action, disarming him, and he waited for police to arrive. When responding, Officer Ian Covey arrived, and when told that the suspect was being held around the corner, he quickly went to the scene and shot Jamel Roberson in his back 3 times, killing him. There has been no accountability in that case. Antoine Rose was a 17-year-old, unarmed, when he ran from a traffic stop.
If you could wrap it up, please. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, looking at the clock, it says I have one. I'm sorry, am I over?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
That's all right. Just take your time. Wrap it up.
Yes, sir. Antoine Rose was 17 when he ran from a traffic stop. The officer who killed him had just been sworn in the department that day after transferring from another jurisdiction under concerns of racism and brutality. The question we must be the generation to answer is, what are we going to do about all of this? Will future generations look back at this moment with pride that we confronted our greatest evils with real courage, or will they be disappointed because we had a moment to make change possible and failed? Right now, that answer still hangs in the balance. Thank you for your time.
That was Lee Merritt with Merritt Law Firm of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mr. Merritt is a civil rights attorney and activist. He testified recently before the Senate Judiciary Committee at a hearing entitled Police Use of Force and Community Relations. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Let's hear now from the Reverend Dr. Doug Logan, Jr. Dr. Logan is president of Grimke Seminary, co-director of Church in Hard Places, Acts 29, and pastor for church planting at Remnant Church in Richmond, Virginia.
Chairman Graham and Ranking Member Feinstein, senators, brothers, sisters, and friends, my name is Dr. Doug Logan, Jr. I serve as the president of Grimke Seminary and former pastor of Epiphany Fellowship in Camden, New Jersey. I serve now as a pastor in Richmond, Virginia, at a church called Remnant. I've been asked to talk about the policing and the use of force. And I come to you today not only as a black man, but also as a Christian clergyman who worked closely with Mayor Dana Redd, my friend in the city of Camden, as I don't want to use the word defund, but I'll use revamp, reteam, and retool the police department for more effective policing and a more effective police force in the city of Camden in 2012, 2013, and 2014. I have lived in inner city for most of my life. Many Americans wouldn't drive through my Camden block after dark or my Patterson block in North Jersey after dark. I speak as someone who has not only observed great injustice, but also experienced them firsthand because of the color of my skin. In spite of all that, however, I speak today not as someone who was filled with rage, but someone who was filled with hope. I am hopeful that we can recover some common ground in this country, starting with a renewed understanding of justice. It must be a vision of justice and equitable treatment of all people who are worthy of dignity, respect, and fairness, having been created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And it must be a vision of justice built on a commitment of all people and their government to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Anything less than this will not provide us with the common ground needed to strive for justice and more than name only, yet I am significantly hopeful. I'm a preacher, so I got 3 points. I pray that we would listen, I pray that we would learn, and then I pray after listening, learning, we would legislate. I pray that we would listen to the cries, the shouts, the screams of black and brown people and many white people that are screaming on the streets for a new day and a new way and real justice and policies to be put in place. I am hopeful that we can reconnect such a vision of justice to our shared dream for a society that promises liberty and justice for all. It is clear from the cries in the streets that many of our nation's citizens do not feel they have equal access to these realities. In view of America's long history of racial injustice, that seems undoubtedly true. As a man who has grown up under the difficult circumstances of inner city America, I lived among what some would call the urban poor. I have been taught that racism is but one of the many problems facing impoverished minority communities, and anyone who blames everything just on racism, past or present, has failed to consider the complexities of those realities and frailties of the human soul. Yet I am hopeful. I am hopeful that we can restore the proper view of the police in our society and those who have been entrusted by and thus will be held accountable to God, the government, and the people. Theirs is entrusted stewardship, which comes with responsibility and greater accountability since they are permitted to use force to secure order and to keep the peace, yet without molesting or denying justice in the process. The police force is a necessary public servant to uphold justice in the midst of societal injustices, and should be an agent upholding the good for all people. Towards this end, let us consider the best statistical data, wherever it is available, to fairly evaluate the rates of police misconduct against minorities. But let us also listen to the stories of the people from the minority communities who almost invariably report statistically unqualifiable instances and bias. Simply put, the facts on the block aren't often recorded in any data. The cries of grandma, grandpa, and my friends and my cousins that we talk about in the barbershop often don't make it to statistical data we can do. So we've listened, we learned. Now I pray that after listening and learning, then we'll legislate. We'll listen to the cries, listen to the pain, listen to the problems, and legislate. If we listen to the people and learn from our cities, I believe we can have comprehensive improvements. I pray for the day for my three biracial sons and my Puerto Rican grandkids that as I was given the talk and told to hold the wheel right and do whatever you have to do to get home. My father told me, do whatever you have to do to get home. The best time to argue with a cop who's mistreating you is a mile down the road while you're alive. So I pray that the talk I'll have with my grandkids and great-grandkids won't be how to survive racist police, but it'll be the talk about in 2020 during a virus and riots that my country, the one I love, came up with wise and radical laws that made them safer. Thank you.
That was the Reverend Dr. Doug Logan, Jr., president of Grimke Seminary and co-director of Church in Hard Places, Acts 29. Now here's Vinita Gupta, president and chief executive officer of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
While the recent murders of Rayshard Brooks, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd at the hands of police officers have once again put the issue of police brutality in the national spotlight, the outpouring of pain and anger is anything but a reaction to isolated incidents or the misconduct of a few bad apples. Instead, the outcry is a response to the long history of violence with impunity toward Black people in our nation. And as law enforcement leaders themselves have acknowledged, from early slave patrols to the modern-day criminalization of people of color, policing has involved the unjust enforcement of unjust laws and helped maintain structural racism in too many communities in this country. We are now at a turning point, and there really is no return to normal. We have to create a new way forward, one that truly transforms policing and leads to more accountability for communities. It is imperative that we get this right, and that Congress's response in this moment appropriately reflects and acknowledges the important work of Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives that has brought us to where we are today. My tenure as head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division began just 2 months after 18-year-old Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri, by a police officer. And the Justice Department was hardly perfect, but we understood our mandate, which was to promote accountability and constitutional policing in order to build community trust. During the Obama administration, we opened 25 patterns of practice investigations to help realize greater structural and community-centered change, often at the request of police chiefs and mayors from around the country. And after making findings, we negotiated consent decrees with extensive stakeholder engagement to overhaul unlawful policing practices and develop sustainable mechanisms for accountability. Police departments around the country studied these consent decrees. They studied President Obama's 21st Century Policing Task Force report to advance best practices. That is not the Justice Department that we have today. Under both Attorneys General Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr, the department has abdicated its responsibility and abandoned the use of tools like pattern or practice investigations and consent decrees. The disruption of crucial work of the Civil Rights Division and throughout the Department of Justice to bring forth accountability and transparency in policing is deeply concerning. In the absence of federal leadership, the Leadership Conference Education Fund launched the New Era of Public Safety Initiative with a comprehensive guide to support local communities on police reform and building community police trust. While a lot of these changes have to happen at the state and local level, success is going to require leadership, support, and commitment of the federal government, including Congress. On June 1st, the Leadership Conference and more than 450 civil rights organizations sent a letter to Congress offering critical recommendations to move us forward on the path to true accountability. They included creating a national standard on the use of force, prohibiting racial profiling and requiring robust data collection, banning the use of chokeholds and other maneuvers that cut off blood and oxygen, ending the militarization of policing, prohibiting the use of no-knock warrants, especially in drug cases, strengthening federal accountability systems, and increasing the Justice Department's authority to prosecute officers under the color of law, creating a national police misconduct registry, and ending qualified immunity. These comprehensive measures are reflected in the Justice and Policing Act. They are necessary for police accountability. Proposals for data collection, commissions, body cameras, these are insufficient responses to meet the moment that we find ourselves in, and more people will die. Where we have seen these kinds of nibbling at the edges policies implemented, we continue to grapple with police officers killing African Americans with impunity. Police accountability and the framework that our coalition outlined must be the cornerstone of any meaningful first steps towards transformation. Ultimately, however, this moment of reckoning really requires more than tinkering at the edges. It requires leaders together with communities from both parties to envision a new paradigm of public safety. That means not just changing policing practices and culture, but ultimately shrinking the footprint of the criminal legal system, including police in Black and brown people's lives. And it means shifting our approach to public safety away from exclusive investments in criminalization and policing toward investments in economic opportunity, health, education, and other public benefits. I have heard police chiefs, police officers, bipartisan elected leaders, and communities that have all been giving voice to these issues. This approach not only furthers equity, but also constitutes effective policy. When we finally stop using criminal justice policy as social policy, we will make communities safer and prosperous. George Floyd's death has impacted the world, and now it is on us to change it.
That was Vinita Gupta, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee at a recent hearing entitled Police Use of Force in Community Relations. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.